There are a lot of things that we need to do to better protect our critical infrastructure, whatever else, but we've come a long way. We really have. And I think we've increased and enhanced our resilience as a country. Our economy is doing very well. I'm not going to say that Mr. Trump had nothing to do with it, but I think it was on a very good trajectory over the last number of years. But these issues that this administration is having to deal with, such as North Korea, Iran, cyber, other things, these are complex and complicated issues. And as Congressman Nadler was talking about before, mentioning demagogues, what demagogues do is try to exploit the fears and concerns of people and come up with simple solutions that are anything but. And that's why I think it's being seen now that the summit in Singapore that took place between Mr. Trump and Kim Jong-un was a big marketing and showpiece, but there was really no substance there. These are issues that really require some of the best minds in this country to really work through over time.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 11th, 2018. The challenges that President Donald Trump has posed to the rule of law are well documented. From his delegitimization of the law enforcement investigation into his campaign and conduct in office, to his attacks on federal judges who rule against the legality of his policy prerogatives, coupled with what many have called his adversarial relationship with his own intelligence community, the Trump presidency has created a role of the executive with no analog in recent memory. On September 4th, at the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, Representative Gerald Nadler, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, and former CIA Director John Brennan, both outspoken critics of the president, sat down for a conversation about what they've seen in the past 20 months under the Trump administration, including their takes on threats to the rule of law, the investigations of the president, and ongoing vulnerability of American democracy to cyber threats. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 346, John Brennan and Gerald Nadler on 20 months under Trump.
I'm going to start at sort of in the middle of things. I'm going to start with the big picture question, and I'm going to start with you, Congressman Nadler. And there's been a lot of talk, some of it yours, in the press these days about the country being in peril, and in particular, the rule of law in the country and the future of the rule of law. And somehow it seems to look to observers and to be presented in the press as something much more fragile than I might have thought a year ago. And I'd really like you to weigh in on this. What threats do you see actually to the rule of law? How new do you think they are? And how fragile the ground that we stand on is it? How fragile is that ground?
Well, I think it actually is fairly fragile. And I'll put this in the context. I'm reading a book now, about halfway through it, called How Democracies Die by two Harvard professors. And some die because of armed insurrection, coups d'etat. We're not talking about that. But others elect leaders democratically who turn out to be authoritarian, either deliberately or by instinct, and undermine the rule of law, undermine democratic institutions, and gradually you lose the democratic society. And we're not immune from that. And I see the rule of law as greatly imperiled. It's imperiled by a president who I don't think is deliberately undermining the rule of law. I think he has no concept of what it means. I think he has no concept of democratic procedure. But he's undermining it by assailing all the institutions that protect it, assailing the FBI, assailing the Department of Justice, trying to make the Department of Justice partisan. His latest tweet, why they, you know, it's terrible that they indicted two Republican congressmen because it might hurt the election. I mean, the Department of Justice is supposed to be independent and is supposed to hold the rule of law without fear or favor, no matter what. Attacking the press and getting a large proportion of the public not to believe anything in the press, attacking the judiciary to try to cow it, undermining the special counsel, doing everything they can to undermine all these institutions that we depend on to protect the rule of law and to protect our democratic institutions. And that is joined by the abdication of the Congress. We depend in the Madisonian scheme under the Constitution on one branch to keep the other in check, checks and balances. We depend on the Congress to hold the president, any president, accountable and to place limits on what he may do. And this Congress, the Republican leadership in this Congress, has chosen not to do that at all. It was amusing last week to see some Republican, I forget who it was, release a letter to Republican donors saying, we got to reelect the Republican House because otherwise here's the list of 100 or 50 or whatever it was, investigations that a Democratic House will conduct. And it gives a list, very convenient, but in effect saying, here's the list of all the investigations we should have been doing but aren't. And if they're elected, they will. And that's a total abdication by the Congress of holding a president accountable. You put this all together, it is a considerable risk to the rule of law. And probably, what is it? That's one of the biggest issues and problems we face now.
John, you can weigh in on that, but I want to ask you something else, and you can sort of talk around it, which is that both of you have been through many presidencies. Republican, Democrat, centrist, extremist. There's been a whole range of presidents during your lifetimes of service. Is this president really an outlier? Is he really an outlier? Is he really as rogue as they say? I mean, I don't want to malign a bunch of presidents from the past, but I can think of a number of incidents where there have been presidents that have done things that are contrary to the rule of law as we know it. Is this really a difference, or are we just going through something cyclical?
Well, I think that everybody would acknowledge, including Mr. Trump himself, that he is different than his predecessors. I think he prides himself on that difference. And I couldn't agree more with Congressman Nadler in terms of how he described the rule of law, which I see as the national framework that keeps this great republic together and has for the last 242 years. It is the disparagement, the denigration, the questioning, the assailing of those institutions of governance, whether it be judicial, law enforcement, intelligence, that really, in my mind, is quite a break from past practice. I served 6 presidents. I got to know 4 of them very well. No president is perfect. No person is perfect. But I never, in my experience, have seen any individual who's in the Oval Office to so thoroughly undermine those institutions of governance and to try to delegitimize those things that keep this country strong and great, whether it be the institutions of governance or whether it be a free and open press. And so I do think this is, people refer to it as an aberration. It certainly is. And I do think that Mr. Trump has taken this to a much higher level in terms of his refusal to honor those great institutions of governance and to try to undermine them as a way to protect himself. That's what's so different here. And that's why I do think we are at a point in our history where there is really going to be a question of whether or not these institutions and the checks and balances in this country can withstand the barrage of attacks of one individual, particularly as Bob Mueller's investigations continue to move forward. So I think the work that Congressman Nadler and others are doing to try to ensure that no single person is above the law, this is what I think really needs to prevail as we go forward.
Okay. We're going to come back and talk a little bit at the end, I hope, about presidential powers and balance of power. But Congressman Nadler, I want to turn to you for sort of one of the elephants in the room, which is election security. We're on the cusp of an election. We still haven't figured out what election security was compromised in the last election, unless you want to tell us something that we should know that we don't know yet. And I just want to, what is it that can be done by Congress or elsewhere to assure the American people that this election and the next presidential election can take place in a fair and reliable and legitimate way, and how far are we from being able to assure that?
Well, we know of 3 different types of attacks in the last election, essentially by the Russians. One was use of analytical data and informing bots and all kinds of propaganda on Facebook and other social media that was seen by upwards of 150 million people, all aimed at getting people to distrust each other and inflaming racial divisions and at helping one candidate, namely Trump. The second was the hacking of emails and the stealing of information from the campaign manager of Hillary Clinton, John Podesta, and from the Democratic National Committee and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. and the weaponizing of that information through systematic release. And some people poo-poo the importance of that, but if you think of the last month of an election, and every day the news says, well, candidate A said this and candidate B said that, what you got for the last month was Donald Trump said this and that, and WikiLeaks released another email about Hillary's campaign. You didn't hear anything from her. So that had a real impact. How much of an impact is unknowable. And the third type of attack was the hacking into election data, that is, into state Board of Elections computers. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as we know, no votes were changed, as far as we know. But they could have, as far as we know, they did not. But they could have, they got into some of the state boards, and they could have simply wiped out. As far as we know, they didn't do this, but they either had the capability or came close to the capability of simply eliminating X number of registrations. So 100,000 people show up in Illinois and suddenly, who are you? You're not on the books. You're not registered. Now, what worries me, and we've done something about the social media a little. We have not done a heck of a lot, so far as I know, about the possibility of hacking into an election, into candidates, but I don't know that that'll happen again. The real problem is that we certainly have not protected state and county boards of elections against manipulation. Now, some states, some counties still have electronic voting. And that is, which means no paper ballot backup as you have in New York, as in most states, but some still have pure electronic voting. And there, you could hack into it and change the vote results, and nobody might ever know. And that's a danger. And they could still cause chaos in the registration systems and all. Or just change them in a way that prejudices one candidate or one party or another. And we're not doing nearly enough to protect ourselves. There's been legislation to give states money and resources. In the House, the Republicans adopted an amendment to zero out the existing money. Mm-hmm. And that didn't get through, thank God. But there has not been a willingness on the part of the Trump administration or the Republicans in Congress to help the states deal with this. And why that is, I don't know. I mean, in 2016, you could say confidently that the Russian attack on our election was to help one candidate, Trump. Next time, who knows? It could be to help Democratic candidate A and Republican candidate B or whatever, or just to sow chaos. But for some reason, they have not been willing to really step up and do anything about this.
John, what about misinformation, though? There's the hacking part of this and the tampering with the voting. And I feel like that's something that we should be able to handle just in terms of expertise and professionalism and, you know, technological savvy. But the misinformation campaign that seems to have been at the root of the allegations about the 2016 election, has, from your point of view, do you think that this country is ramped up to prevent this again? And how do you approach this kind of problem?
Well, since the birth of our nation, electoral politics have lent themselves to hyperbole, embellishments,
really
and sometimes dishonesty and mischaracterization. And usually it was, for a couple centuries, the realm of print media and the few television networks that are out there. But over the last couple of decades, there's been this explosion within the digital domain that is now the ecosystem where so much information is resident and available, from the true and accurate to the ugly and false. And that new environment is the place where most people these days do get their information. And so it has lent itself to being exploited by those who want to try to manipulate people's perceptions. So there's just so much more opportunity now than there was in the past. And unfortunately, whether it be domestic individuals who just want to create havoc or have political agendas, so they want to really skew people's understandings of issues, or it's our foreign adversaries who now see the opportunity to go into that environment and to propagate its narrative and its version of the truth. And so this is a real challenge for us, and certainly in electoral politics. So when I was seeing the Russian efforts in 2016, it brought home two things to me. One is that the Russians are going to be determined to try to influence U.S. politics, and they they are quite capable of doing it. But that exploitation of that digital environment is something that the Russian exploitation is a symptom of. And I still don't think that we as a country have come to grips with just how important it is for us to do what we can to make that digital environment as secure, as reliable, as resilient as possible. And it's the thing that when I was in government, it made my head hurt the most, because it really is a very, very complicated issue. And not just from a technical standpoint, but also from a free speech standpoint. Mm-hmm. And the role of the government in that environment. So this is something that I think we really need to, you know, push forward on. That's why I'll continue to call for an independent commission. Just like after 9/11, when there was a 9/11 commission that was established, that then came forward with a number of recommendations that changed government institutions. After the war in Iraq started, there was the WMD commission as well, bipartisan independent commission set up by Congress. There needs to be a similar one for the cyber environment, so that we bring together all of the smart people, the technologists, the futurists, the scientists, the private sector, business people, to say, okay, how are we going to deal with this environment to ensure our future safety, security, and prosperity? I'm not smart enough to know the answer to that, but I'm smart enough to know that we really need to do this from a strategic standpoint. Otherwise, we're going to be facing the equivalent of 9/11 there. And we should do this before we hit that crisis point rather than after.
Do you think we're distracted, Congressman Adler, and that's why this hasn't happened? Are we distracted by the political environment? I mean, why hasn't this kind of commission been stood up? Could Congress take a role in this?
Congress should, certainly, and it's a good idea to set up such a commission, I think. I think we have been distracted. The administration reacts totally defensively to any question that our elections can be manipulated, because the president views that as questioning the legitimacy of his own election. And the Republicans generally go along with that because they don't want to buck the administration. I mean, I can't think of any other explanation for why they would oppose funding to protect our elections. They just don't want to admit that there's a real problem there, because that could be read as calling into question. I mean, remember, all of our intelligence agencies tell us the Russians tried to rig the last election in favor of one candidate. Half the Republicans won't admit that that happened. And certainly the administration won't admit that that happened. So when you're putting your head in the sand, it means you don't want to deny certain realities. It inhibits you from taking steps to prevent those non-existent realities in the future, I think is what's really going on.
Speaking of distractions, what about the judiciary's persistent looking into Hillary Clinton's emails?
Judiciary committee, you mean?
Yes. What did I say? Commission. Yes.
Yeah.
Committee.
Not just into Hillary Clinton's emails. The majority, the Republicans, the majority on the Judiciary Committee is investigating. They refused to investigate the last election, which we wanted them to do. So we had an investigation by the House Intelligence Committee, if you can call it an investigation, but at least supposedly an investigation. In the Senate, there was one by the House Intelligence, by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and by the Judiciary Committee, because it's our jurisdiction. We should have been doing that. But we refused to, or the Republicans refused to do that. Instead, we have this investigation of the investigation. The investigation of the investigation that resulted in no charges against Hillary, and an investigation of the beginning of the Russian investigation to show that it was poisoned at the beginning by biased people, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, Bruce Orr, other villains, and I suppose poison the fruit of the poisonous tree. And therefore, we should discredit Mueller and whatever he finds, because after all, it was all started for terrible reasons by terrible people. And that's what they're wasting the time and effort on. And unfortunately, one of the byproducts, I mean, if they want to waste time and effort, that's bad enough, but one of the byproducts, besides the intentional disparagement of institutions that we need, like the special counsel and the FBI and the Justice Department generally, is to intimidate, deliberately to intimidate, to hold up, to put public ridicule, civil servants. Some of them political appointees, some of them career civil servants, but you hold them up to ridicule, make them spend tens of thousands of dollars on legal representation in front of congressional committees, all for nonsense. And this is to intimidate current and future people. Don't stick your neck out.
Yeah. John, I want to ask you a question. You know, Goodlatte, and Representative Goodlatte and Nunez have talked about bringing you in to testify about, I assume, the election, and I'm not sure what else. Do you think they will? And if so, what do you think the calculation is, and why?
Since I left government on January 20th of 2017, I have gone up to the Hill to testify either publicly or in closed session or be interviewed over a half dozen times, I believe. And every time they've asked me, I have said yes, because I want to do what I can to inform and to let people know what I did, what I believe, what I think we need to do as a country. And so I know that Chairman Goodlatte has said something that he's going to call me in or subpoena or whatever else. They don't have to subpoena me. Ask me to come up. I will talk to you. You know, was I a perfect public servant? No, I wasn't a perfect public servant. But I did try my best. I tried to be honest with them. And so now I'm being, you know, pointed to as one of those villains that Congressman Nadler mentioned, which is really quite interesting, because when I was in the Obama administration, there were far, far more Democrats calling for my resignation or my firing than there were Republicans. Now I'm evil incarnate or whatever, and because I'm not a Republican Democrat. I've tried to call it straight, but if I'm not playing by the rules that they set up, so I'm ready to testify in front of any of the committees I have already. I think it's critically important that we get to the bottom of what happened, both from the standpoint of how to better protect our infrastructure, as Congressman Nadler was saying, but also to understand whether or not anybody was cooperating with any foreign entities to try to subvert the integrity of our election. That's critically important. But what Bob Mueller is doing, we need to be able to see it come to completion. And if he decides that, you know, nobody violated any laws or whatever, we need to accept that. But if he goes forward with additional indictments he already has, I think we need to put our trust and confidence that this is why we have a Department of Justice, this is why we have the rule of law in this country, so that we can address these issues and problems as they come up.
The Mueller investigation. What are the consequences should he find that there was some kind of, dare I say, collusion in the election?
Well, we've already found there was clearly collusion in the election. I mean, just the fact, the publicly known facts, just the fact that Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort, the campaign manager, and some others go to a meeting with people representing themselves as representatives of the Russian government and say, we will give you information, negative information on Hillary Clinton, as part of the Russian government's attempt to help Trump in the election, which was the email setting up the meeting, said that. And they go to the meeting for that, to receive that information, Trump Jr. replies, if that's what it is, I love it. That by itself is probably a criminal conspiracy, just those facts alone, even if it weren't followed up. But I expect it likely that they will find that there was, remember, we're not looking for collusion. It's looking for violations of law. And the violation of law would be criminal conspiracy, conspiracy to defraud the United States, or maybe to hide campaign contributions, various different things. They have already indicted quite a few people. They've indicted, two dozen Russians, Russian nationals, and three Russian companies for involving our election to help Trump and to sow chaos. They've indicted the president's campaign manager on unrelated charges, the president's lawyer and quote-unquote fixer. It's interesting when you have someone known as a fixer in your employ, has allegedly told people that he was present when the president was informed of what happened at that meeting. If it is shown, I mean, it's clear, I think, that they're going to show various crimes. Some have already been convicted of crimes. Various crimes involving interference in the election, collusion with a foreign power. The real question is whether they'll be able to show and prove that the president personally was involved in that. That is a big unknown. It's unknown to me, to the public, what Mueller knows, who knows at this point, but it's a public unknown. If they could show that, if the president personally were involved in breaking laws in order to accept help from a foreign power to affect an election, it would be the most serious consequences, I think. And then all options would have to be on the table. I mean, it's to have a president who conspired with a foreign power to subvert American democracy, if you could prove that that actually happened, would be an almost unimaginable situation.
Yeah, I agree with that, which is why it might be a good idea that it takes a little bit of time. But if you did have these hearings in the judiciary, is there anything you'd like to ask Director Brenner, as long as we have him here, just in case he's in Thailand or someplace at the time may happen?
Thanks, sir. Well, I suppose what I'd like to ask Director Brennan is, what can we do to repair the damage to our intelligence agencies, to our law enforcement agencies that have been done by the attempted politicization and by the trashing by the president and by some others of them?
Yeah, that's a good point. I believe that the intelligence and law enforcement professionals are continuing to do their work every day to the best of their ability. Does it bother them the way that they have been referred to and their noble professions have been denigrated? Yes, it does. I'm sure it bothers their families, the ones that are on the home front that are frequently without their loved ones because their loved ones are working around the clock to keep this country safe. Does it bother the young students here at Fordham and other places who are thinking about going into law enforcement intelligence? I bet you it does. Questioning whether or not they want to do that and have those make those sacrifices while you have somebody in the Oval Office who doesn't appreciate their work and tends to be selective in terms of what he agrees with or not. So I think it's critically important if the chief executive is not fulfilling his responsibilities on that front, that Congress has to. I must say that the Senate Intelligence Committee is doing a pretty good job in terms of bipartisanship. Richard Burr of North Carolina and Mark Warner of Virginia, I think, are working this review quite well together. Unfortunately, the House Intelligence Committee has been a travesty. And Devin Nunes, I think, has really just totally, totally abdicated his responsibilities and putting his personal and party interests above all else. So I think if the intelligence law enforcement communities believe that the Congress, at least, is going to try to make sure that they are protected and they're not going to be subject to abuse, that is going to go a long way to giving them the sense that what they're doing is going to be recognized, appreciated, and used. Because if you're going to go to the lengths that you do for law enforcement or intelligence purposes, you want to make sure that your work is going to actually contribute to this country's safety and security and prosperity. And I think there are some people who would question that now, because if the person at the very top is not going to take that into account, it does hurt. But I must say, my former colleagues are some of the most patriotic and dedicated Americans, and I have confidence that they're going to weather the storm the best they can. But I do hope that there are going to be less stormy seas ahead.
Do you agree?
Well, I agree, and I would ask a further question, which I don't expect an answer to right now, but I simply say that if we take the majority, the Democrats, that is, I would want to know if you think there are any statutory changes that we can make to further protect the CIA and other agencies against some future president who might have similar attitudes.
Well, I know there are a lot of issues that are being looked at right now, and I think your committee is well-placed to address whether or not there can be some legislative initiatives to try to protect the special counsel.
Special counsel, certainly. We have such a legislative initiative, which is reported by the Senate Judiciary Committee, has not held a hearing on the floor, and of course in our House they won't look at it.
Yeah, I mean, there are, I guess, constitutional questions. I'm not a lawyer by any stretch, although I spent more time than I would like to admit with lawyers, but a question whether or not the president's constitutional authorities can be adjusted by the Congress like that. But I think, I don't think the framers of our Constitution anticipated the events of 2017 and 2018, and so you think they did?
They didn't anticipate this, but what they didn't anticipate was the development of political parties. That was the problem. So that, for example, there was a discussion, and I always forget whether this was at the Constitutional Convention or at the Virginia Ratifying Convention of the Constitution, but there was a discussion of the pardon power at that convention, and a delegate named James Iredell, who was worried about the pardon power being considered being too broad. And he raised the question and he said, well, what if the president engaged in a criminal conspiracy and pardoned his co-conspirators to hide? And Madison answered, oh, that could never happen. If that ever happened, he would be immediately impeached. Thinking, obviously, the impeachment power was a limit on the pardon power and not anticipating the fact that Nobody's immediately impeached because you have a political party that's allied with the president who's not going to be so eager to do that. So things have not developed in that way, but they did think about it.
But I guess there are questions about whether or not a president can pardon himself, since it's not explicitly precluded by the Constitution as well. And I think it was Washington who talked about the real concerns about partisanship in this country, that that was going to divide us. And certainly over the last couple of decades in particular, asked me before about, is this so different than in times past? I have never seen the degree of partisan rancor and animus and dysfunctionality in Washington that there is today, including on the intelligence front. I remember when I used to go to an intelligence committee hearings years ago, each member, whether it be the House or the Senate, they would put their party affiliation at the door. They'd park it there. National security and intelligence and law enforcement would not become a political football. Well, unfortunately, it has become it, and I think it's been accelerated and intensified because of some of the things that are coming out of the White House.
But has that become a political football since the Trump presidency, or was that already underway before that?
I think the trajectory was in that direction, but then I think there has been acceleration since then because so much is looked upon in terms of what the president, what he or she might say or do, and it just sets a tone for everybody. And I think the tone that is being set since January 20th of last year is a much different tone than what you've seen before. And, you know, President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, President Bush before them, I worked for all of them. And although I didn't agree with a number of their policies, each of them, I think, set a tone that they were going to be above this type of petty, I don't say partisanship, but pursuing their own interests above all else. And I think this has had a very corrosive effect on a lot of what's going on in Washington right now. And even among some Republicans that I really greatly admire and respect and had, I think they have been sort of pulled into this vortex. And now they're trying to protect the interests, the equities of the President of the United States, who I think has gotten them out on a limb that is very, very difficult to defend now, their integrity and their honor. And unfortunately, I think too many of them have abdicated that.
Which brings us to a discussion, as I said, we get back to this, of the presidency itself, which is that the things that this president is doing seem to defy reason, but they don't necessarily defy the law. The president, they may, but they may not. The president does have tremendous powers that he can exercise. And what I'm really getting at is here, do you think when the dust settles, there will be some rethinking of the presidential powers and how they're construed and articulated? Because there are other presidents who could have done this, and they didn't. So is it really, and you talk about tone, is it really just a matter of, and we've always kind of said that, God forbid so-and-so should be in the White House, or do you think that we may be getting to a rethinking of just how powerful the president should be or is?
I'm not sure how to answer that, except to say that we depend, any democratic society depends not only on written constitutions and laws, but an adherence to generally accepted norms, norms of behavior. You don't attack the press too much. You can disagree, et cetera, and Spiro Agnew to attack the press, but within limits. You don't attempt to persuade people that everything you see and hear except from my press or my office is fake news. You don't attack the independence of the judiciary. You don't attack people in the executive branch. You don't attack and seek to limit the independence of the Justice Department and the law enforcement branches. You don't do all these things. And you don't do them because they're against the accepted norms of behavior, which we very much depend on to maintain a democratic society. This president is doing all of that, and nothing is stopping him from doing it. Hopefully some things will change after November and some things will stop him or make him pay a high price for it so that it won't set the precedent for future presidents behaving this way. We elect a president who's supposed to be bound by law. In America the Beautiful, one of the lines is, confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law. And this president doesn't seem to understand that, but we have to make sure that for the future that's done. Whether there can be certain statutory improvements, maybe, depending on how the question plays out. For example, there is a dispute among constitutional scholars as to whether a sitting president can be indicted. There might even be a dispute with the would-be Supreme Court justice as to whether a sitting president can be subject to subpoenas or although despite the Nixon case and the Clinton case, I would hope we would make that clear in the future. I think no person is above the law, and the president should be subject to indictment, despite what the Office of Legal Counsel says. That may be tested. It may not be. But I think we should clarify these things in the future.
I'm an advocate of having a strong chief executive. Having worked in the government for many, many years, I see how important it is for there to be somebody at the very apex of government who's able to orchestrate and to lead the government, and particularly at times of crisis, whatever else. And I think we've seen ample demonstrations of that over the years from presidents of both parties. I think over the years, the two-party system and the primary process that would identify candidates from each party did a pretty good job of weeding out those elements who might have been on the fringe or reckless or irresponsible. But I unfortunately don't think that Mr. Trump had the experience, the background, the credentials, the maturity to fulfill that office. And what I would be hesitant to do is to really change the system because Mr. Trump became president. I wouldn't want him hamstrung. When I was working in the White House for President Obama's first 4 years and then the CIA, I frequently would be frustrated that Congress had such a check over the presidential powers because I really wanted him to be able to do more things. Now I'm sort of on the other side of the ledger. I'm looking for Congress to exercise that restraint. So I think we have to be very, very careful about taking apart the system of governance and our executive branch framework because somebody like Mr. Trump happened to find his way to the top of the political party primary system and then find himself in the White House.
I would generally agree with that, but I'd make two broad caveats. One is presidential war-making powers have come out of control in the last 40 or 50 years, certainly since World War II, and that's something we should deal with. Secondly, it was interesting that you said the constraints or the gatekeeping function. Political parties have performed a gatekeeping function against demagogues and charlatans becoming the president. But we have, without perhaps thinking about it, we've removed the ability of parties to do that. Initially, after the revolution, congressional caucuses nominated the candidates for president. Then with Andrew Jackson, you got the institution of the party conventions, which were really conventions of delegations from separate state parties. But those delegates were selected to a large extent by what we today call party bosses, local operatives, local heads, etc. And they could get together and say that Joe, he's a demagogue, he can't win, let's support him. And that proved too rigid, certainly in 1968, when it was too rigid to allow the dominant opinion within the Democratic Party electorate of opposition to the war in Vietnam. And it was a block against that. You nominated a candidate who was pro the war in Vietnam. And the result was, besides electoral catastrophe for the Democrats that year, the result was a felt need to really reform the system. And it was reformed. And binding primaries were introduced, primaries that bound the delegates, where the delegates were no longer delegates of local parties, but were selected by the candidates. You want to run for delegate today, you pick a candidate, you get on the candidate slate in your district, and if he gets 40% of the vote in your district, then 40% of his delegates are elected, but you're loyal to him, not to the local Democratic or Republican Party. And an attempt to limit this was made in the Democratic Party by superdelegates, the idea being, well, have some constraint on some demagogue coming in and running away with the system. The Republicans didn't do that. And what happened this year, well, 2 years ago, was a demagogue came in, overwhelmed the entire Republican Party, basically. I mean, you had 16 candidates. Virtually nobody in the power structure of the Republican Party wanted Trump. But his appeal, whatever it was. There was a lot of, I think it was racism, ethno-nationalism, all kinds of things, just overwhelmed it. And they nominated a candidate that nobody in the power, in the Republican Party, I shouldn't say nobody, very few in the Republican Party would have selected to start with. Democratic Party, the superdelegates are essentially gone now as of last week and never had a real impact anyway. So the two political parties' gatekeeping functions are largely eliminated. Someone with a demagogic appeal, it has now been very clearly shown, can steal a political party, even if he has tenuous allegiance to that party, no history with that party, but a demagogic issue now. And that's an issue we're going to have to deal with somehow in the future. We have to find a better balance between enabling parties to perform a gatekeeping function, and which they no longer can, as was just shown, and not allowing a party structure to deny the felt will of a majority of the party over the war in Vietnam or whatever other issue may come up. We haven't got that right yet.
I want to just ask you one question following up from this, which is, it's one thing to talk about the fragility within and what problems are posed by this presidency. But we hear every day in the news about how we're under attack from without, whether it's because of Russia and the election, or Russia and other things, or China and intellectual property, which has been in the news in this past week, largely because of the president, but also elsewhere, or Iran, or North Korea. But just from an assessment of having lived in this world for all these decades, one thing I always do at our events is try to calm everybody down and say, so everything's good. So my real question is, given that we have such disarray in Washington, how are we doing in terms of our ability to protect ourselves in the world?
We're all doomed.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, you're right, and it goes back to, I think, what I was mentioning before about the digital domain. There is so much opportunity there for good, but also so much opportunity to try to steal intellectual property rights, or to gain our secrets, or steal identity information, or whatever. But I do think that this country's system is very strong. There are a lot of things that we need to do to better protect our critical infrastructure, whatever else, but we've come a long way. Good. We really have. And I think we've increased and enhanced our resilience as a country. Our economy is doing very well. I'm not going to say that Mr. Trump had nothing to do with it, but I think it was on a very good trajectory over the last number of years. Mm-hmm. But these issues that this administration is having to deal with, such as North Korea, Iran, cyber, other things, these are complex and complicated issues. And as Congressman Nadler was talking about before, mentioning demagogues, what demagogues do is try to exploit the fears and concerns of people and come up with simple solutions that are anything but. And that's why I think it's being seen now that the summit in Singapore that took place between Mr. Trump and Kim Jong-un was a big marketing and showpiece, but there was really no substance there. These are issues that really require some of the best minds in this country to really work through over time. Tearing up the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iranian nuclear deal, just because it was something that was forged by a previous administration, that was no basis to do that. So I think that despite the problems, certainly that I have, and the concerns I have about this administration and this president who decides on a policy and then tries to get the rationale to support that, I think we still are the strongest the country in the world that has tremendous economic, military, political power and influence. But sometimes I believe we're squandering it by dealing with a lot of these issues in a manner that does not do justice to their seriousness, their complexity, and their gravity. And there needs to be as strong a process as possible in the national security environment, the area that I'm most familiar with, in order to deal with these issues and not trigger some type of foreign crisis that really could affect us in a very fundamental way.
Would you agree?
I'll agree with that in part and disagree in part. We are very powerful. let me disagree on the economy. The economy is going along at a decent growth rate, and the GDP is growing. But, and this is not a partisan thing, and it's not of the moment, but for the last 30 or 40 years, income and wealth have been increasingly skewed, so that the middle class is being eviscerated, and more of the wealth of the society is going to a smaller and smaller share of people. That's ultimately unsustainable and unstable, as well as wrong, and we're going to have to deal with that, and that's a major issue that we're not dealing with and not really admitting, although there's some political turmoil about it, but it's something we haven't dealt with, and a lot of people want to put their heads in the sand. Second, on the general geopolitical thing, we're in a time of turmoil. Put it a little in historical perspective. You generally get or can get major wars and dislocations either when major powers are collapsing or major powers are emerging. That's the history. And when Germany was emerging as a major rival to Britain, etc., you know what happened, for example. Now, the Soviet Union, interestingly enough, was probably the most heavily armed country on the planet in 1990. 4.5 million men under arms, 40,000, whatever it was, nuclear weapons, etc. 2 years later, it didn't exist. For a major power like that to collapse without catastrophes and wars and all kinds of things, it was almost miraculous. I think Gorbachev deserves a lot of credit for that. But that we lucked out on, or maybe we handled it, President Bush handled it well from our end. But now you have to handle the emergence of China in a way that is challenging American dominance in the Pacific and the interests of allies like South Korea and Japan and Australia. That's going to be a tough, and they're spending a lot of money on the military and in ways that are potentially destabilizing. That's the situation. And they have cyber capability. So China and Iran are probably the two most destabilizing powers at the moment and have a potential for causing havoc. And we have to manage that. And hopefully we'll be skillful enough to manage it. But it is a challenge.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Center on National Security at Fordham Law for providing audio of the event. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell and music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.